He's the same guy who got caught doing illegal things inside this premises on this ground here when I was in ninth grade. Remember having a teacher and pastoral conference in that room right over there. And it's still funny to think about that. My, how the tables have turned. I feel like I should have the theme song to the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air playing. You know, how my life got flipped, turned upside down. That's exactly what happened. That's probably the real simple, easy way to describe it, is my life got totally flipped upside down. You know, as a kid growing up, I never had like a lot of, I mean, I'd be afraid of certain things, but I was never one to really question who I was, like, you know, as far as my place in the world or any of those kind of weird, you know, debacle questions. Pretty confident, you know, for the most part. But, I mean, I had my other little things, you know. When I was growing up, I grew up around here, went to Highlands Middle School, Pine Estates Elementary and all that. And, you know, fighting became like a regular thing. Got into a lot of, you know, it was all over. You know, I've met guys that went to school in California, went to school in Chicago and all this and that. And they said they moved to Florida and went to Highlands Middle School and it was the worst school they ever went to. I'm like, wow. I'm like, I mean, at the same time, it's wow, but at the same time, it's like, it's not really that surprising. I mean, given my experience there, I mean, I was walking home from school one day, and I had kids throwing bottles at me, beer bottles, and that was a normal thing. And, you know, at the same time, as much as I didn't like that, I did that the same thing to those other people, too. So, I mean, what can I really say? You know, that was kind of my view of the world, you know. You walked around, you had your chest puffed out, and that's what you did because you didn't want to look weak, you know. And that, to me, was the way of strength. That's what strength looked like to me, was walking around tough, you know, the John Wayne kind of, you know, cigar hanging out or dip in your mouth or whatever, you know, post it up. You were a tough dude. Obviously, you were. That's what you were representing to the world, right? So it had to be so. So that was my outlook. So that's what I did, you know. And I figured out if I was going to be a tough guy, I had to do tough guy things, you know. And so that's what I did. You know, anything I did, it had to be the best, the toughest, or the most hardcore appearing, you know. And I thought that's what I was supposed to be doing. And, you know, I was raised in church, and this church specifically. But I never really heard and never really grasped what they were talking about. You know, and not until a year and a half ago, I never knew what they meant, you know, what the importance was of Jesus being put on the cross. It just never really clicked for me, you know. I'm like, why do you have to do that? He's God. Why would you need to do that, you know? But like Jesus said, those who have ears to hear, those who have eyes to see, you know, and hear. So I didn't have them, you know. And a lot of that, I guess, would boil down to kind of, you know, if you don't believe that we're all born into sin, I don't think you've ever had children. Because right out the box, bro, they're pretty hard to handle. They're very, very selfish. beautiful, yes. Cute, cuddly, yes. But selfish in nature just to begin with. I mean, from the get-go. And that was me. I was very selfish. I always liked the people that I was around. I always loved people, so I thought, my conception of love at least, which later on found out that wasn't even a good description of love. I mean, but anyway, so I started out like the normal kids, you know, middle school and high school area. Lord, at least where I grew up, it was normal for us. Started out smoking weed, of course, you know, and all those kind of things. And there's always that debate of whether it's a gateway drug or not. And I'm not really here to dispute that because it's just, for me, it was. And that's all I can really speak of is for me. It opened a door. Now, my mind was open to that door before I ever smoked anything. You know, that is one thing that is for sure. So it started off with that, you know, and that kind of grew. And I'd go a while. I was never like really hooked on it, I wouldn't say, but there were times I'd go like a year, year and a half, and I wouldn't smoke or do any of that kind of stuff. Just because caught up in whatever I was doing with football, or, you know, I did karate and all that kind of stuff too. And, you know, but it was something I would do if I ever got around those guys. You know what I mean? We was going to be doing that. We was going to be doing something, you know, finagling some way to do it somewhere. You know, and there were times where I wouldn't be doing school, doing good in school and things of that nature, and my home life wouldn't be so great, you know, obviously. But thank you. And I remember thinking one time, I think I was in like eighth grade, I was like, you know what? As bad as this day was, at least I can go to sleep and I can still have my weed when I wake up. You know what I mean? I still have that, you know, no matter how bad this day was. And so I'd lean on it a little bit from time to time, but didn't really need it, you know. But anyway, so I grew up and get out of high school, you know, and in my house, it was, I wouldn't say real strict. There were some definite guidelines. And we all knew what they were, and you didn't cross them or penalty. And sometimes I accepted penalty because I didn't want to ruin that weekend or with my buddies, and I wanted to be with those cool guys. You know what I mean? And it was so important, looking back, it was so important to be with those cool guys. You know what I'm saying? Because, again, I had to have that appearance, you know, on the outside. But I get out of high school, and I do okay. Could I have done better? Oh, yeah, a lot better. But I didn't have that mindset, you know, and I think in a way, in a large part, for a lot of younger people growing up, you know, for a guy like me and my personality to sit in a chair for a while and listen to you speak, and then you want me to retain any of that, you're fighting against nature. You know what I mean? You're going against the grain. It's not natural. You know, and I almost say it'd be better if you started school off with like when the kids are like 10, you know, and started them off small. Because with me sitting in a desk for 7-8 hours, dude, it just don't work, you know. Now, maybe, but then definitely not. Brain was too, you know, I heard people say they had the squirrel running in their head. That squirrel would be just running, you know, it's like the Charlie Brown, wah, 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 wah. You hear the parents talk, that was the teachers for me, you know. But so anyways, I get out of high school reasonably unscathed, and I figure, well, you know what, I got tired of playing football, so I quit doing that. You know, of course, I look back and wish I could have done or tried harder with it. But I got out and I decided, well, I'll just go to college and I'll do it my way. You know, I'll just go, despite everyone's teaching and preaching at me, oh man, you get that scholarship and do it right, you know. I don't know. It's like a mental block or something. I didn't want to do it that way. I wanted to do it my way. And I still wanted to be in town and with those cool cats and still be able to party and do whatever and then do some school too. You know what I mean? Kind of stuff that to the side a little bit. You know what I mean? But so that's what I did. I did okay in a few classes, dropped out of a few. Eventually, I got to where I was working on my own. I'd moved out of the house, moved in with a girlfriend, and all kind of stuff like that, and figured I could figure it out and do it on my own. You know, I was always kind of a see-the-pants, kind of happy-go-lucky kind of guy anyway. You know, so I figured that'd work out all right, you know. I guess it's when you're that age, you never really have an idea about how much the world can be a negative place. And I never had a conception of the things that I would do or those things of the world can be, like me and my dad have talked about, can be very sticky. You know, you don't just do them and you go through unscathed. That's the biggest lie out there, man, is that you can do all these things and do all these fun things that sound good at the time and get out of it unscathed. It don't work that way. A lot of these things stick with you. Can be very, very difficult to get through, like walking through like a big tar pit or something. You're going to have some stuck to you, and it's going to leave some lasting things. But so I started to get into those kind of things. I got into those tar pits. And, you know, I worked in a restaurant business, and, you know, I think within 2 or 3 months I picked up smoking. You know, because if you didn't smoke in the restaurant business, you didn't get a break. Only the smokers got a break. So I'm like, well, I guess I'm going to be a smoker then, because I like breaks. So that's what I did. I started smoking and eventually drinking, you know, which I'd done that little bits here and there and had some bad experiences along the way. But, you know, I guess you figured you'd not good at something once, you keep trying until you get good at it. I don't know. So I did that too, and eventually that led in like the party scene and got into like cocaine and you know, I did like hallucinogens and stuff like that too, but not only like the mild ones like mushrooms and whatnot. But I started doing that, and so that became the, you know, work's tough, whatever, my girlfriend sucks right now, whatever, I got this. I can go do this with my boys, you know what I'm saying? And so we, every weekend, you know, or eventually it just turned out to be more of a every other day kind of thing. We were going to go and get something. You know, we didn't care what it was, really. I mean, if it was ecstasy or weed, marijuana, I mean mushrooms, or we were pretty open. We always did say, you know, some of the harder stuff, heroin, crack, all that kind of stuff. I remember we all, you said, oh, man, I won't go that far. I think it was a month before I actually said that, and then I tried crack for the first time. I think it was a month. And I said that specifically. I will never try that. But eventually, before that, I eventually started having a dealer deliver to me at the restaurant I worked at, you know. And I would go and do it on the bathroom on a break, and they were like, man, Vogel's lazy before, man. He comes out of that bathroom, he's ready to work. You know what I'm saying? And I had no problem telling him at the time, because I was stupid. You know, I guess that's the only way you can put it. I'd come out of that bathroom and be like, yeah, man, I'm on this right here, and, you know, let's get this thing done, knocked out, you know, and everyone just kind of laughed, oh, whatever, you know. And then eventually I started losing weight, you know. Pounds started falling off as the months go by, and then eventually I got with some guys, and this is all in this area, that were from up near Soutel and that whole area. And so I started hanging out with this dude, and he's lived over there for years, you know, pretty much mooching off his grandma, as I came to find out. And so I started hanging out with him. You know, we always, as a kid in like the D.A.R.E. program, you have these images, you have this image of people that are in that kind of lifestyle as the guy like on the neighborhood watch sign. You know what I mean? Wearing like a Carmen Sandiego outfit with a brim up and a hat, creeping around the neighborhood. That's what you think they all look like. Well, guess what? They don't look like that. They're funny. They're charismatic. They're likable. They really are. And everything's not so usually cut and dry, black and white, is good and evil. You can talk to almost any old person and find some good in them, or find some likable character about them. And so with me, I would block out all those bad characteristics and find those things that I liked about them, and I got along with them. I mean, that's why I got along with everybody. I was in high school, and I had friends in every clique. You know, freaks, cowboy dudes, you know, black guys, whoever. It didn't matter. Everybody. I was friends with everybody. And I guess, I don't know if I'd say, like, I had this, I wanted everyone had to like me, because I sure had plenty of beefs in my time. So, but I always found a good characteristic, especially if you were doing the things I like, which is party, you know what I mean? We were down. I could find something I like about you, you know? So I started hanging out with those guys, and eventually tried methamphetamine with a guy that was really cool, and I wish him well to this day. A guy named Steve. He was a great guy, man. He was so funny, lively. He was from Arkansas. It's hilarious, man. He had this funny accent, and he'd tell me these stories of how he'd be on this stuff, methamphetamine, and, you know, I guess he worked in some factory or something where they had to unload these bins every night, and he set, like, the company record one night because he was up on methamphetamine all day. And I was like, wow, that's got to be great stuff, you know? And so I go to start doing that with him, and one thing struck me wrong, because, I mean, again, I still had some moral fabric to me. You know, it wasn't like I was just like, you know, oh, whatever, we'll do whatever we got to do to make what I want happen. I wasn't that selfish yet. But one day something struck me wrong. I'm in his house, and he's got like 4 and 5 year old kids, and they walk in, and we're in there smoking methamphetamine. And I'm like, yo, Steve, man, your kids are in here, bro. Should we be doing this? Oh, ain't no big deal, man. I don't know what's going on. I was like, okay, whatever. You know, that's his kids, his problem, I guess, I figured. We went on about it. And I think I was up for 3 days. That was the first time I ever tried it. And, But, so I kind of opened myself up to that arena. But I still say, I'm never trying crack. Like, that's worse. But, so, eventually I go and I hang out with another dude, and this is the guy off of Soutel, and he says, yo, I got this stuff, man, because he knew I tried that meth with Steve, and he's like, yeah, I got some meth, man, y'all try this. And he hands me this little glass pipe, and I'm an airhead, I don't know what it is. He's like, yeah, man, try this. And so I did it, and it was fantastic, made me feel great. And but I noticed later on that day, that night I went home and I passed out about 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm like, you don't pass out on methamphetamine, you know. And so I was like, he's just like, huh, yeah, I don't know, it must have been some bad stuff. I talked to him about it. It was crack cocaine. He had been asking me to get on it with him and want me to try it with him, and I always resisted. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to go that far. You know, so he was trying to ease me in. And, you know, it's like the old thing, misery loves company. You know, and I guess that's what he would say. You know, and he knew I was making okay money for myself at the time. You know, I didn't have a lot of bills to pay. But, so eventually, I think he just came out and said one day, oh, yeah, I think that might have been this other stuff I was doing. I think that was crack. I was like, really? It wasn't bad. So I started doing that with him. We planned this big party this one week, and it was we were going to stay in this hotel for a few days. So I invite a girl, and he invites a couple people. Well, it ends up just being us and a couple of these, an older lady and a younger girl who later on I found out she had just gotten out of rehab. I didn't know that at the time. But anyway, so we get there at this party, and they all start smoking, and she, right off the bat, breaks out a needle. She starts shooting cocaine. It's like that thing, wow, that escalated quickly. I think I've heard that on Facebook or something like that. And that's kind of how it happened for me. I mean, this is all this I'm talking about is in a matter of like a couple months, you know. And so she starts doing that. Well, I say, I want to be cool because I like this chick. I want to be cool with her. So I was like, I'll try it too. And so I tried it too, and it made me feel awesome. And but I never really had that feeling like I had to have these things or like there's urges. I didn't really have that. I liked it. To me, it was just a fun time. That's the way I saw it. Again, I was unaware of these sticky things of the world. But when these people started doing all this, one of the ladies there, she was probably mid-40s, 50s even. She was hanging out with the other guy, Mike, that lived off Soutel. And so they all start doing it. And right as soon as they do, they start wigging out, dude, peering out the mini blinds. You know, they're thinking there's cameras in the daggum. I'm like, dude, we're at like a Motel 6. There ain't no cameras anywhere in here, you know? Because me, I'm fine, you know? I'm good, but they're wigging out, dude. I mean, this one lady, she was not high unless she was sitting in the corner of a room with two knives in her hand, hiding in the corner. And you can't tell me that's fun anymore, but you're way beyond the fun part. You're way beyond the fun. You have to do it now, you know? And I thought they were all nuts. So I keep doing it, and we end up staying there. We quit our jobs and all kind of stuff, you know, just to keep partying. Just got a fresh paycheck and everything, you know, we're just going to blow it all, you know. And 3 or 4 days later, I was just like they are. I was a crazy one. I remember it like it was yesterday. I was sitting in that hotel, and we started doing more, and I lost my mind and thought everybody was after me. I mean, paranoid. So we leave the hotel, and I'm so geeked out, man. I can't even hardly talk, can't even hardly walk. I'm freaking out, thinking the FBI is after me. Like the FBI cares about what John Zachary Vogel's doing. You know, 18-year-old nobody at the time, or 19 years old. And so we're driving around. We're going to go to his buddy's house. And now, I'm hooked at this point. I mean, three or four days, and I'm completely hooked. I went from, like, Mr. I'm confident, big, strong, to, like, fiend. Like, I got to have this now. It's a long story if I get into all the details, which I'm not going to do about this time frame, but I will say it was the scariest, it was the scariest time of my life up to that point, by far. Nothing was even close. Paranoid, thinking people are hiding behind trees, thinking FBI is after me. One time I actually did get tailed by an unmarked vehicle, black tinted windows, probably narcotics officers thinking back on it. It's probably narcotics guys scanning the area. Whatever. They did follow me for a little while. I mean, I was in a Ford F-150 four-wheel drive with a 6-inch lift kit riding through the hood. You know what I'm saying? I stuck out like a sore thumb. You know, and I get into many horrible days. It ends up I'm running around with prostitutes, driving them from place to place, drug dealers taking them to different places. Used to have a guy that used to love getting a ride with me because I had that big old truck, and I'd take him out to Ocean Way. Then we fit in. You know, then we're low profile, you know what I'm saying, in Ocean Way. So we used to do that. And it was so freaking scary. I remember sitting in alleyways off of 63rd and Main, hiding back because I didn't want nobody to know I was in the truck. Because over there, bro, they don't care who you are. If they don't know you, you're going to have a problem, you know. And so I did the best I could to hide out in that big old truck, and just shaking, man. And, you know, eventually when my money ran out, Mike kicked me out of the place I was staying at with him, you know. But we was homeboys. Let me tell you about them tough guy homeboys. And I listened to a little bit of Lecrae here from time to time. I don't know if y'all have listened to Lecrae, but he is awesome. I mean, not only that he has positive things to say, but he also, from someone who grew up listening to some rap, I listen to a little bit of everything. This guy's got some serious flow, too. I mean, he's good. You know, and he says, everybody rats on everybody in the jam. Everybody. All those homeboys that are posted up, that's skin deep, dude. They will all roll, you know, and my buddy did. He said, you can't stay here no more. I mean, it was just one day, bam, my money ran out, no job, no nothing. Got nothing to pawn. They used to always try to talk me into stealing things from people. I never would do that. Never got to that point. Didn't say I wouldn't. I never did reach that point. And so basically I was of no more use. So I was put out. And I remember staying in hotel parking lots, sleeping in the truck, Walmart parking lots, wherever. And it was the loneliest, most horrible time I ever had up until that point. I remember praying, though, one day I was riding around trying to make something happen, trying to do some kind of hustle to get money, and I remember praying all day. I said, God, please, please, Lord, deliver me from this without me having to go to jail, without dying, you know, those kind of crazy things. Lord, please just give me a shot. I'll take it. And I mean, I prayed that prayer all day. That might have been the first time in my life that God actually heard me. You know, I don't know. I mean, I know he hears this all the time, and he's always there, but he heard that one. He heard that one because that was probably the first sincere prayer I ever actually had. You know, please deliver me from this. About 2 weeks later, I think it was from that point, my dad walks in the door of the place I was staying in, just a house we smoked crack in. This couple lived there, and I was just kind of staying with them. And he just walked in the door. Doesn't knock on the door, just walks in. I don't know if y'all met my dad or not. Walks in the door, and this is the first time in my life that my dad came up to me and wasn't forceful, wasn't trying to force me to do anything, but I could see the concern all over his face. And it was genuine, just love. Zach, please come with me. And that's what stuck with me. And I said, all right. And I remembered that prayer that I prayed. And I said, this has got to be it. This has got to be the answer to that prayer. So I said, all right, I'll take it. And now, still in my selfish drug addict mind, I had no real desire to stop. You know, that wasn't the breaking point. But I figured, you know what? He was solid with that. I wanted to do it to appease him, really. And I could see that I hurt him, you know. And so I went, but I figured, you know what? I'm sitting in this rehab facility, inpatient program. And I'm like, you know, I'll get out. And I got to get control of this thing, you know. Maybe I'll just get a job and just kind of do it here from time to time, you know. And so I was just going to be a part-time crackhead, I guess. That was my plan. That don't work. I mean, maybe for some people, not for me. Go big or go home, you know. That was the way I always looked at it. So anyways, but so I'm in there, and I'm wigging out the first day. You know, I think everyone in there is crazy. You know, I'm calling him up. Dude, please, you got to get me out of here, bro. This is nuts. There's people walking around with slippers, you know, sucking thumbs and all kinds of stuff. I'm like, dude, yeah, because I was better than that. But that's what I thought at the time. But it wasn't until I didn't actually have the desire to stop doing that action until we had this parent conference. And it was actually a family conference, and my little sister was either out of town or visiting relatives or something. And, you know, little sister Millie, she was probably 15 or 16 at the time. She's pretty young, and she looked up to me, and I was really glad that she wasn't there. I don't think at that point that she knew anything about it, which I was glad for. But it was my mom, my dad, my older sister Jennifer, and we're talking to the counselor, and he's looking around the room and feeling us out. And I think that he said these words to me with the intent of get me to break, or to get me to see what I actually caused. Because when you're doing all these things, you don't have kids, you don't have a family, you don't think you're hurting anybody. You know, I didn't think that I would be hurting them. I thought, you know, I guess they don't know what I'm doing. They ain't hurting them. You know, what mama don't know don't hurt her. You know, like that's something that you can hide. So we're in that meeting, and he looks around the room, and he says, you know, I think this is hurting the most. I said, who? He said, your older sister. And I looked over at my sister, and she was bawling, crying. And that freaking broke my heart, dude. You know, I mean, I grew up, I got in fights for my sister many occasions, sticking up for her. You know, I always felt that. Now, do we always get along? No. You know, do we disagree to this day? Yeah, we do, sometimes. But I love my sister. And I knew, I never questioned what I would do for my sister or any of my family. So that killed me. That was the straw that broke the camel's back at that point in time. And so then my ears were open a little bit. And so I started doing this program. It was a Narcotics Anonymous-based program, like a 12-step program, with some good, good people. And I started to hear and started to see a little bit, too. Started going back to church. Started to hear a little bit more when I was in this room, as well as those rooms. But I was still 19, 20 years old. And I never wanted, you know, I won't do those things. I was sober for a while, and eventually, you know, I got to go out and get a job, and, you know, I worked with my dad for a while, and then eventually got in the restaurant business, which was probably a horrible idea at the time. And so, of course, there's the bar scene. Move from one thing to the other. And that's what I did. I didn't want to be that guy that was 20 years old and could never have a drink, you know. Who wants to be that guy? You know, I still wanted to be fun, still want to have good friends, and I still wanted to party, you know. Now, I knew what the other path would lead to with that hard stuff. I knew that was bad, you know. Figured that out. If I ever questioned it before, I made that solid in my mind. Can't go there anymore. So But I started a party here and there and made a lot of friends and got into that whole clique and eventually got a job at Murray's Grill, which is now closed, which is a shame. But got into a lot of stuff. I remember actually thinking my buddies, when I didn't go out, they would have these cool, grandiose stories of what happened the night before. And I'd be so scared to miss out on that that I had to go every chance I got. I don't care if I had to work at 6 in the morning. I'd be out till 3. It didn't matter. And I would be so painful the next day. My wife's shaking her head back there because she's seen my face with that. It was so painful. But I was so scared to miss out on something fun, you know, to have that story and join in those stories with those guys. It was kind of a camaraderie thing. I was always put a lot of emphasis on my friends. I always loved my friends, do anything for my friends. I was always one of those guys. Or my so-called friends. But eventually I meet my wife there at Murray's, and I remember that was a whole God moment too, just meeting her and when I decided to actually kind of pursue her. And I remember thinking before I chose to take her out on this, not like a date, I was just going to take her for a little drive. She was having a rough day or something, and I just remember this thought, hey, why don't you go and ask her to go, you know, take a little ride, you know, ease her mind a little bit or whatever. And I remember thinking at that moment, if you do, your life is going to be different. I remember thinking it was like one of those forks in the road. It's funny how you have those. You know it. You're cognizant of it or whatever you want to say. This is going to split. This is the direction. And I remember having that with her when I decided to take her out on that ride. And I remember I was in my dad's new Blazer, extreme Blazer he had, and I had this pretty lady in the seat beside me. And I felt so bad, you know what I mean? I'm like, from where I've been, this is a good seat, dude. This is a good seat right here. And I remember being so proud to have her in the car with me because she's so beautiful and everything. And so we end up starting dating, and I quit smoking, quit drinking, quit doing all those things because she at that moment filled that void in me, you know. And everybody, if you look around, everybody has that void in them. And the people are trying to fix it with all these different things, all these things of the world, you know, these quick fixes, these things that give you instant gratification or make you feel better right now. We're in such a right now culture anyway. You know, everything in America is pretty much built on right now. McDonald's, Redbox, you know. Oh, that's not fast enough. Netflix, bam, even faster. You know, that's what it's all about. So we start dating, we're working out, and I quit all those things, dropped everything, you know. She was the best thing that happened to me at that point. I remember feeling so lucky. I remember talking to her one night at her dad's house. I was like, man, from where I've been, I'm the luckiest dude in the world. And I probably really was. Luckiest dude in the world, man, to be at that point, man. I felt so good about that. And I always knew that God had answered that prayer. And I believed in God. I believed he existed, and I believed what I'd heard in church, that I believed Jesus died for me. I don't know why he had to die, but he died for me, you know. But it never clicked. It never made sense, and I never made that decision to give my life and will to God. You know, I found on later on that there's a big difference from just saying, I believe in Jesus, to saying, direct my life. I give you my life. I can't do this on my own. There's a big difference. And that's what made the biggest difference in my life. Well, again, the quick fixes in life. My wife, of no fault of her own, at that time for me, she was a quick fix. Something that filled that void. And that's why I started to improve. Now, that's a good thing in one hand, but a bad way on the other, because I'm filling it with the wrong thing. Later on in life, I'd heard that everyone has a God-shaped hole, and everyone's filling it with things that don't fit. And that made sense, because that's what I've been doing my whole life, filling that God-shaped hole. But eventually, I started to hang out with my buddies again, you know. And it was about around the time when life started happening and things started to get serious. She got pregnant with our first kid. We moved in together. and started having to do my job and start to try to provide. It's about around that time those quick fixes didn't work no more. And so I go back to lean on the old friend alcohol and tobacco and start doing all that stuff and started partying more with my buddies. And, I mean, it'd be some nights where it'd be 4 in the morning. Sometimes it wouldn't be till 8 in the morning I'd get home. And scared to miss something, you know. And of course, love the feeling. But it took a long time. Alcohol is one of those things. It takes a long time to get a hold of you. You know, methamphetamine, crack cocaine, all those things are very quick. Very quick, and they'll get grab a hold of you real fast. But alcohol is that thing. It's acceptable in society. You can do it just about anywhere. And you do have fun. I'm not going to sit up here and say I didn't have a lot of fun. There was some times of a lot of fun. But eventually what happened with me is all those fun times started to fall away. After years and years, my buddies in life started to move on, started to have families. And they moved on to that next phase of their life. But guess what? I was still here. You know, I thought I was the road dog or whatever you want to say. I was going to be the most hardcore. I got to keep living this way. What are y'all doing? Y'all are failing me. You know, a bunch of quitters. That's the way I kind of looked at it, I guess. I'm like, where's everybody going? And I was still in that place. Eventually, I was sitting on a bar stool and thinking to myself, this isn't even fun anymore. I remember thinking while I'm drunk, I don't learn anything new here. There's nothing new I learn here. It doesn't progress me at all. It keeps me right in the same spot. I didn't think that much in detail about it, but I do remember thinking that thought. I don't learn anything new at a bar. And I remember jokingly saying it to some of my buddies, you know. But eventually, years and years of this went by, and years and years of piling on resentments in my wife's eyes towards me broke our relationship down. And she dealt with it for years and years and years. I have no idea how she dealt with it that long. Because now I look back at it with a sober mind, I'm like, could I have stuck with it that long? There is no way I would have stuck. I would have caved long before she did. And eventually everything was just torn away. Just the whole fabric of our relationship was gone. The day I found out for sure that our relationship was gone. She was ready to move out, you know, the whole thing, dude. Gone. That was another one of those breaking points, like my sister when I was in rehab. I actually got a clear view because I had like a couple days or like a day of sobriety or something. And I had a clear view what I'd done. And where I'd taken us, you know, because like the Bible will tell you, as a father and as the man of the house, you are the spiritual leader of the household that you're in, okay? And if I'm the spiritual leader of my household, then where did I lead her to? So that it had to have been God talking to me because I never thought this way before. I was always so selfish, you know. Where did you take her? I'm like, dude, I took her down a horrible path. You know, and for me to sit here and be mad at her for wanting to leave, how can I even do that? So I said, all right, well, I got to do something myself. I got to do something. I got to that point again. I'm desperate. I'm willing. I got to do something. So I call up a program with CSX, and it's a employee help program, employee assistance program, as they call it. And they started asking me personal questions about me, and then they started asking me about my drinking, because I basically called them up to get marriage counseling. That's all I thought we needed. You know, I didn't see the whole, dude, alcohol's not good for you. I didn't see that yet. Didn't want to see it yet. That's really more the accurate description of it. But I call them and start talking, and then they start asking me about my drinking. How do you drink? What do you do? I said, well, yeah, I drink. Well, it's not every day, you know, but when I do, considerable amount. You know, there's several occasions I drink 12 hours straight, you know. But that's what we all did. That's what all my buddies did. You know, it's funny how your world gets surrounded by all those people that enjoy the same things. You know, and you think that's what's normal. Well, guess what, dude? That was not normal for me. That was not normal. You know, there's a reason why they all moved on and I was still there. And all every time they'd get a new girlfriend, they're like, you need to stop hanging out with that dude. You know, I was always that guy. I'm the bad friend. And, so they say, well, we think, you know, have you ever blacked out from drinking? I said, oh, yeah. That was like pretty much the goal most of the time I drank, I think, you know. So they recommended me seeing somebody and talking to a counselor and at the Greenfield Center in Jacksonville. Great bunch of people there. I go in there, and my wife, another testament to her, is, you know, as far gone as I thought we were, she says she's going to take me up there. I'm like, okay. Didn't think that much of it. But the counselor, when I got there, was like, dude, you're really lucky to have her here with you right now. Most situations that I encounter, she's not there. And so I was like, oh, that's cool. I guess I didn't think that much of it, you know. I knew it meant something, you know, that I knew she cared about me. She just couldn't hardly stand to be around me, you know. But he starts asking me questions, the counselor there, Brian, and he says, do you think alcohol is a problem for you? I said, no, I think I know I need to slow down or whatever, you know, get a handle on it or whatever, chill out, you know. I know I drink too much on occasion. Not as bad as I was. That's the way I always thought about it. It's not as bad as I used to, but I know I needed to get a handle on it. And he asked me, has alcohol ever caused you problems? And I'm thinking back, yeah, let's see, a year and a half ago, before this time, I'd wrecked my motorcycle, skid across the ground, took all my freckles off my arm and my forehead, and, you know, at one time, a little while before that, I cheated on my wife, and in an alcohol, you know, situation, and just a whole mess of other stuff. I've probably forgotten more of those bad things that alcohol has caused for me than I remember. And I said, well, yeah, it has caused me some problems. He says, doesn't that in and of itself make it a problem? I said, you got a point there. And so I said, all right, I'll listen to this dude. You know what I mean? He's convinced me. And so I start going and attending. I'd go there 4 days a week and started getting help there. And again, there were a 12-step-based AA program. And, you know, which there's some misconceptions about those places. Some people think they're almost occultish or whatever you want to call it. I'm going to tell you right here, it ain't. Because it wasn't in this room that I got renewed back to God. It was in that room. It was in those rooms. And it for me, it led me directly to God. And when I started to open up the book of AA and those kinds of books, group kind of therapy setting type stuff, almost every page of the book of AA said something about a higher power or God or getting to know him, the creator or whatever. And it's also said in there how the people that didn't grasp that concept, their chance of getting help was slim to none. And I'm like, and there's a chapter in that book called The Doctor's Opinion. And the doctor's the one saying this. This is a PhD. I mean, this is what he does. This is back in the 30s. His sole thing, his practice was about helping alcoholics. And every scientific help that they could come up with at that time had no effect. Almost helped nobody. It was of little to no effect. When they started to develop that program, this was the only thing that he saw that ever helped anybody. That hardly helped anybody. I thought that was amazing for a doctor to be saying that. And there's also a chapter in there to the agnostic about the one who's not sure about God or the atheist. And it was still saying in there, the ones that can't grasp the concept of a higher power in general or God in general have little to no chance. So you have to come to that point, and I did for me, where my way of doing stuff, because I tried to quit many times. My way of thinking, you know, the way they put it is you have a disease, and it's a problem of your mind, and a spiritual problem as well, but a problem in your mind, and you're trying to sit in your mind and correct a problem with your mind. It's not going to work. And that made a lot of sense to me, too. But so I started to hear those things, and my eyes were opened up. You know, maybe it was because a lot of us people, especially younger guys in today's day and age, we hear all the bad things about religion, and about what's in this book, or more often than not, it's about the people that you have the resentment toward that were presenting it to you. So it's people's presentation of what God is that we all have a resentment toward at some point or another. Seemingly. I know I did. I always thought it was kind of hokey, wacky, people praying in tongues. It sounded crazy to me, you know. I remember I was at a church camp when I was 16, and everyone up there to line up, and they all got touched on the forehead, and they all passed out. And guess who was still sitting in my chair? Me. I ain't going up there. It ain't happening to me. It scared me to death, you know, and thought it was silly. You know, I thought it was, oh, they passed out because they wanted to fall down. You know, they just wanted that. I had no idea. You know, when I started to get help and open my mind up to God and the idea of Him, and the third step when I got to that one was made the decision to give your life and will over to God as you understood Him. By that time, I'd started to go back to church because I figured they all kind of went together. I was like, okay, this book telling me if I don't get God, I'm not going to get help. If I don't get help, I'm not going to have a marriage. I'm not going to be able to help raise my kids. So I'm going to do whatever. You know what I mean? So I opened my mind up, and I said, whatever. You give me a recommendation, I'm going to go do it. So I got in the book of AA, got in the Bible, and started going to church, going to meetings, and just tried to go all in, you know, because I wanted it, and I needed it, and I knew that whatever was inside of me was not capable of doing it in and of myself. So there's a couple things that stuck out to me. I'm not going to read a whole lot out of here just because we don't have a lot of time. But I'm going to read you Psalms 107, 1 through 22. And these different books, and this one and the book of AA, I found places that told my story. You know what I mean? That it's like, dude, that was me. You know, in Psalms 107, that was me. Says, give thanks to the Lord, for He is good. His love endures forever. Let the redeemed of the Lord tell their story. Those He redeemed from the hand of the foe. Those He gathered from the lands from east and west, from north and south. Some wandered in desert wastelands, finding no way to a city where they could settle. They were hungry and thirsty, and their lives ebbed away. Then they cried out to the Lord in their trouble, and He delivered them from their distress. He led them by a straight way to a city where they could settle. Let them give thanks to the Lord for His unfailing love and His wonderful deeds for mankind, for He satisfies the thirsty and He fills the hungry with good things. Some sat in darkness and utter darkness, prisoners suffering in iron chains, because they rebelled against God's command and despised the plans of the Most High. So He subjected them to bitter labor. They stumbled, and there was no one to help. Then they cried to the Lord in their trouble, and He saved them from their distress. He brought them out of darkness, the utter darkness, and broke away their chains. Let them give thanks to the Lord for His unfailing love and His wonderful deeds for mankind. For He breaks down gates of bronze and cuts through bars of iron. I'm like, dude, that was me. That was my story, dude. I was in darkness. I was all wrapped up in them chains and them tar pits like I was talking about earlier, man. And the sins and deceitful things of life were just straight sticking to me. And it's like that dream, you ever have that nightmare, you're running from some monster and you've got concrete shoes on and you can't hardly move. And that was life for me, you know. And I didn't know why, but I knew this, that when I opened myself up to Him and gave my life to God, those things fell away. Not all of them all at once. A lot of these things were not that, hey, I'm going to do this for you. I'm going to fix this for you. More like, come walk with me. I'm going to do this with you. And so I had to do a lot of those things with Him, you know, and He started to give me these little nudges on things to do and actions. I remember sitting thinking, when I decided that I'm going to try this and I'm going to continue to try with my marriage, that God would tell me, don't worry about what she's doing. I'm like, well, she might be doing this. She's out talking to this dude or that dude, whatever. God said, don't worry about that. You need to worry about what you got going on. And I said, well, Lord, I just want my wife to love me again. And He said, then you need to love her. You know, it's so many things of the kingdom of heaven work that way. You know, it's like the old pay it forward theory you've heard, Dad, I'm sure. You want to be loved, you need to go show them love. You know, why don't you do this for me? You need to do this for her. You know, so I started to, okay, well, what is love for her? Washing dishes, picking up, not being dirty and throwing my stuff all over the floor, helping her out, being willing to help her out, you know, and doing it in a way that's just straight kindness. And that's the way that Jesus worked, man. I mean, that's what started to touch me about his story, was that by all right, when he came here, he should have been worshipped. He should have been sitting on a throne, you know. By all right, he could have done that. Jesus didn't come here to be served. He came here to serve. And that's what touched me. I mean, everyone talks about, oh, he hung out with sinners. Yeah, he washed their feet. He did more than just hang out with them. He washed their feet, you know. And like the prodigal son story, when I came home, he put a robe on me and a ring on me. You know what I mean? And treated me like gold. One of the other ones is Matthew 13, 45 through 46. Touched me in a big way. This is the parable of the merchant. And I'm not going to turn there just out of time, but the parable of the merchant was basically there's a merchant in search of a fine pearl. And when he found one of great value, he went and sold everything he had to get it. And I remember when I first read that, I was like, God thinks I'm a fine pearl. I'm like, dude, I didn't do anything to deserve that title. That's for sure. None of us did. None of us did. None of it is out of deserving. Because he loves you. I mean, it boggled my mind. I remember I was sitting on a beach one day, and this is 6 months, and I've been sober. And I'm sitting on a beach, and I just wanted to spend time with God. I'm just chilling, taking some pictures. It's cool. It's like a cloudy day. Murky, but there's turmoil in the ocean, and to me, I find that beautiful. You know what I mean? I mean, the sunny, nice, beautiful days are cool too, like the tropical scene, but sometimes I like those, you know, the world's, you know, the clouds are in turmoil, and the water's all, you know, rough, and to me, it describes a part of him as well, not just the pretty side, but, you know, there's a little bit of that God that's kind of crashing waves and churning up, and it's another cool characteristic about him that I found to like too. And it is manly, and it's not posted up, and it's not fake. It's just cool. It's him. And so I'm sitting there on that beach, and I'm like thinking of that, because I'm thinking of that Matthew, you know, the parable of the merchant. And I'm thinking about that and just kind of mulling that over my head. I said, Lord, teach me how to love my wife, my family that way. That's how I want to love my family. Sold everything I had to get it. And I'm just in there meditating about that, and God says, you did. So what do you mean? It's like your family was a fine pearl. You sold everything you had to get it. You dropped friends. You dropped alcohol. You dropped all those addictions to get them. I said, thank you, Lord. That just blew me away too, how he flipped it like that. And that same one about 3 months later flipped it on me again. Just like I said earlier, everyone has a God-shaped hole, and everyone's trying to find something to get it, to fill it. And again, I just came across that parable again, and you know, in studying, and I was thinking about that everyone's got that God-shaped hole. And I said, and if everyone's got that God-shaped hole, that kind of makes them like a merchant in searching for something. And then that would make God or Jesus the fine pearl. And when you find that pearl, you sell everything you have to get it. And that's, my life kind of was like that too. I'm like, now my mind's blown. I just had it flip three ways on me in a matter of a couple months. He was the fine pearl. When I found him, I sold everything to get it. And for the people on looking, when you see someone that you've known for a while, and then they say, you know, dude, hey, man, I'm a Christian now, bro. And it's like, I remember when my friends would come to me, I'm like, oh, no more fun with that guy. That's the way I used to look at it. But now, there's a reason. Now when I look at that, it's such a beautiful thing. So you'll see this guy come out, just flip from this one dude who'd get into everything with you, get all kind of nasty stuff. And then now he's just a totally different guy. Softer spoken, helpful. And he's not going out to those same places anymore. You can't help it. You can't help when you experience the love of God. There ain't no going back from that. There ain't no going back. I sat right up here one night, on Wednesday night. A lot of you ladies were here, and a friend of mine, a sponsor in AA at the time, was with me, and everyone laid hands on me, you know. And then just like that time when I told you when I got on crack, it took me 5 days, and I was the crazy one. Well, guess what? When they laid hands on me, I was the crazy one. I used to think they were all nuts. It's funny how things flip like that for me. But when I experienced that, it was just a feeling of all mercy, all love, and I knew, standing right up here where I could barely stand, that I didn't deserve to be there. But it was such an honor. And then I looked up, and my mom was praying on me right in front of me. And it broke me to my knees almost, you know. And I thought she was funny. She was one of those people. And then turns out life happened to me, and guess what? She was right. She was right. That was perspective for me. But thanks for letting me share. I appreciate you guys being here. And Mom, if you want to come up, and we'll do offering and close.